Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, March 17, 2014. Eastern Equatorial officials change their mind and decide more than 30,000 IDPs can now stay in Nimule after all.
We have accepted that this guard force, which they call Protection and Deterrent Force, PDF.
And the top U.S. official in South Sudan says U.S. supports efforts to end the fighting in South Sudan.
We've supported it with financial resources, with funding for staff, as well as for helicopters to be able to fly and observe whether one side or the other side or neither side is observing the cessation of hostilities.
We'll have these stories and more coming up in South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan government officials say they have agreed to a resolution to deploy forces from five regional countries to help contain the ongoing crisis. Officials say the forces will remain as long as they are needed. Lucy Pony has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
During a regional heads of state meeting in Addis Ababa last week, the leaders adopted a resolution to deploy a protection and deterrent force to South Sudan. South Sudan spokesperson Michael Makwe-Lueth says the number of forces has not been agreed to, but they will come from Burundi, Kenya, Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Rwanda.
We, as a government, we have accepted that we were a party to the talks. And we have accepted that this guard force, which they call Protection and Deterrent Force, PDF. We have accepted it to be deployed because this is the force that will actually protect the GMTs, the verification and monitoring teams on the cessation of hostilities and the protection of the facilities.
When the government and opposition forces signed a cessation of hostilities agreement in late January, they agreed to allow the Intergovernmental Authority on Development to deploy the monitoring teams, but the two sides have still not agreed to the number of monitoring teams that will be dispatched to South Sudan. Makwe says when they arrive, they will be protected by the regional force. He says the stabilization force will not be involved in any sporadic fighting that continues between the National Army and anti-government forces. He says the African Union and United Nations will financially support the force.
According to the ACAT resolution, it is the AU and the UN that will bear the cost, but they will be under the command of the African Union.
The new force will add to the international troops already in the country, including more than 10,000 UN peacekeepers and an unknown number of Ugandan soldiers who are supporting the government. IGAD has called on both sides to ensure the progressive withdrawal of all armed groups and forces allied to either side. In a statement issued on Thursday, IGAD also said the Protection and Deterrent Force will receive a clear mandate and operational guidelines to carry out their duties in South Sudan. It did not elaborate on those guidelines. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Nairobi.
Last week, we had the U.S. ambassador to South Sudan say the U.S. expects both sides at the peace talks in Addis Ababa to resolve their differences quickly and peacefully, and for the government to uphold the right of journalists to do their job. In the second part of my interview with Ambassador Susan Page, she reiterates that there can be no military solution to the political crisis in the country. The ambassador says the mediators of the Intergovernmental Authority for Development should include views of civil society groups and the seven released SPLM leaders.
My government is supporting the monitoring and verification mechanism. We've supported it with financial resources, with funding for staff, as well as for helicopters to be able to fly and observe whether one side or the other side or neither side is observing the cessation of hostilities. This is going to be an ongoing battle because right now both sides are still posturing for control on the ground and fighting continues. Until that mechanism is up and running, I think we're going to be struggling with seeing the parties continuing to fight. And we just simply reiterate that there cannot be a solution militarily to this conflict, to something that is first and foremost political and where the demands of the people do need to be heard. Right now, the talks are on a pause, and a civil society conference is going to be organized in Addis Ababa next week. And we're looking forward to that and having the mediators and the parties be able to hear from civil society some of the grievances that have led to this conflict.
There's been a talk of formation of an interim government that will exclude Dr. Riek Machar and President Kiir. Is that a viable option?
I think that right now it's important that the fighting stop on the ground. And as the peace talks get underway, we are working with IGAD to offer any suggestions, but it is the mediators who ultimately will be putting forward a variety of different proposals after having listened to all of the parties, not just the warring parties that have taken up arms, but also to civil society as well as to others, including the seven detained who were released to the custody of Kenya. They also have some words to say, and I think it's important that the mediators hear from everyone in South Sudan that can be represented.
And the government in Juba has been on record saying that they are doing their best to correct some of the issues that Western diplomats have been raising, issues such as human rights abuse, security sector reform, and then media freedom. You are coming from Juba. Have you seen any concrete signs of improvement?
No, I think right now, especially while they are in a crisis and the government is, the rebels are fighting the government, I think it's very difficult to institute any of these reforms on any sort of a longer lasting basis. Before the conflict broke out, they were in the process of trying to adopt a civil society, non-humanitarian organization bill in the parliament that severely restricted fundamental freedoms and human rights. So this has been a trend. I don't think that it's new during this particular time, but I do believe that it will be difficult for them to make the changes that are necessary, especially at a time when so many in the army have deserted or have defected to the rebel side. That, to me, indicates that there is a much bigger problem, and it is not something that only the outside powers supposedly want. The people of South Sudan are speaking and saying that this is not how they would like for things to go, or they would not be defecting in such large numbers.
That's Susan Page, U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan, speaking to me at the State Department here in Washington last week. Tomorrow, in the final part of my interview, Page shares her personal feelings about South Sudan. The climate for journalists in South Sudan has become even more difficult in recent weeks. Several journalists have been taken to custody by security officials and questioned about reports critical of the government. Tom Rhodes is the East African representative of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He says the same thing is happening to journalists working in rebel-held areas. Rhodes tells VOA fellow Nabil Biagio that both sides are guilty of preventing journalists from reporting what is happening on the ground.
It's getting worse and worse. I mean, without sounding too dramatic, I would say it's getting worse by the day. The level of tolerance towards journalists from both warring sides is reaching zero. Very recently, or last week, as you know, the information minister basically told the press, both local and foreign, that they couldn't interview the warring side, the rebel side. So we're forced now to report in a very one-sided manner in South Sudan, whether you're in the government-controlled area or the rebel-controlled area.
Why is the government not happy with journalists?
There's a variety of reasons. I mean, of course, I'd have to speculate a little bit since I'm not part of the government. One reason is that when this conflict started, the government line on the conflict was that it was an attempted coup by the former Vice President Riek Machar to usurp the government. Some believe this is true and some don't. And I believe that the media community has tried to be as impartial as possible and try and show both sides of the story. And government officials do not seem to like this kind of professional journalism and would prefer that only their side of the story is narrated.
From your statement, the statement released by CPJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists, it seems that the government is restricting media freedom in South Sudan. What are the red lines set by the government not to be crossed by journalists when reporting?
There are a lot of red lines, and it seems like they're growing more like red marker lines. The one that I've just mentioned, of course, the fact that you're not supposed to interview the rebels or show their side of the story Many media houses have gotten in trouble just for doing that. That's a big one. But other issues too, which journalists, you know, off the record often confide to me, is that they fear reporting on issues such as corruption and anything involving the president, in fact, President Salva Kiir.
Before the comprehensive peace agreement that ended the North-South civil war in Sudan, media coverage of the war was very biased in Khartoum. Now, the CPJ has been also concerned about the treatment of journalists in Sudan. How do you compare that to the treatment of journalists in independent South Sudan?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's a tough call to make. I've been to both countries, Sudan and South Sudan. And, well, relatively speaking, I think you can say that conditions in Sudan, especially in Khartoum, are still worse. The high level of censorship and intolerance Khartoum regime has against their own press is certainly very terrible, and it has been for a long time. But what makes the situation in South Sudan so worrisome is that one of the reasons that the SPLA, the former rebels, now the government, fought for 22 years was for greater freedom and for greater civil rights for the public, including press freedom. And while conditions in South Sudan may not be quite as terrible as they are in Sudan yet, they are getting that way. And we are worried at CPJ that those who fought against oppression will now become the oppressor.
That's Tom Rhodes, East Africa representative of the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking to VOA fellow Nabil Biagio this past hour. The spokesperson for President Salva Kiir is denying that journalists are not being arrested or detained in South Sudan based on their reporting. Wek Ateny insists that no journalists have been arrested under the Kiir administration.
To be honest with you, national security has never actually questioned any journalists, because what I know, all the journalists that are accredited here to South Sudan, whenever they have any problem with the national security, they always call me. I have not received any calls regarding anyone that has been stopped by national security. If there is anything that has led into certain journalists coming to national security, you know, it is just to receive an advice, because some journalists are actually very irresponsible and they write very irresponsibly.
And these journalists are also saying the line is not drawn clearly, and most of the time they are saying once they report on activities of the rebels, they are being accused of supporting the rebels. How do you react to that?
One of very fundamental things in journalism is for the journalists themselves to look at what the effect of their journalism allow them to say and what not to report. If we say the truth, you look at the fact that any country in the world, and you know those foreign journalists who come to South Sudan to work in the field of journalism, should also think that when they are trying to say something, they should think in line of the laws that govern their own countries, and they try to avoid things that can incite citizens or things that can threat national security. Like last time, a Jazeera journalist was reporting saying that the rebels are within 60 miles to Juba, which has caused panic, and that was not the case in the ground. That's why, he was actually asked to leave the country.
My understanding is that you are saying that the government in South Sudan is not harassing journalists. Is that what you're telling me?
The government is not harassing journalists, but it is the journalists who are even very irresponsible, to the extent that the government at the end of the day must have to ensure that the media law goes to the parliament so that it is passed into the bill, so that it regulates the media, because some media are acting very irresponsibly, like those who are actually publishing articles written by rebels, and even those radios who actually talk about and make interview to rebels, you know, saying that we are going to capture this city or that, you know, these are some of the things that, you know, the law will have to deal with them. But because we have not yet, signed into law anything that will regulate such behaviors, we have allowed anybody to do what they think, you know, is good for them. And it is good for the journalists to ensure that they look into that effect.
Yeah, they are doing that in the name of freedom of speech that is enshrined in South Sudan's constitution.
Well, the freedom of speech is not free. Even in the Western world, I am trained in England. I was in England. And I have seen a number of people being arrested during the Iraqi war. So this is not the first time. So you cannot tell me about the freedom of speech. That is limitless. All the freedom of speech has limitations. We have not yet provided for limitations within our enacting laws. And this is what we are working to ensure, that the limitation comes clearly, so that those who are operating in South Sudan look at those limitations. As a sovereign country, we cannot be dictated by those who wanted to pass their own agenda.
That's a presidential spokesman, Ateny Wek Ateny, speaking to me this past hour from Juba. Eastern Equatorial state officials reversed an earlier decision and now say more than 35,000 displaced people can stay in and around Nimule. Residents worry about overcrowding as a result of that decision. Philip Aleu traveled to Nimule over the weekend and has this report for VOA.
A group of women singing a protest song over the government decision to allow tens of thousands of displaced people to stay in Nimule, hours after officials make the public announcement at a local primary school on Saturday. Gali Jiruko, a youth leader from the local Mahdi community, says the decision makes no sense. He says the majority of the new arrivals are from Jonglei State, where most residents raise cows as their primary source of income. He says in Nimule, most people grow crops and they are afraid the animal owned by the IDPs will trample them. He says when locals try to explain this to the displaced people, they don't listen.
Sadly, some of the IDPs are armed and very hostile. They have refused the offer by the government of Eastern Equatorial State to relocate them to the non-congested areas outside Madelan. Moreover, the armed men are using their guns to intimidate the local people.
Officials had announced in mid-February that they plan to transport all 35,000 people to Kafoida and other areas of the states that are not as heavily populated. Knowing many locals are upset with the decision, Governor Luz Lobong Lojure dispatched teams to evaluate the conditions and determine if there is enough space around Nimule to accommodate all the IDPs. It says both communities should be able to peacefully coexist if some rules are established.
We have closed the chapter on IDPs. We are here to talk about the other big issue, the cattle. The issue of cattle is what I want to be heard. They will take this issue to the president. That is a crisis because the cows are eating our crops and destroying our farms.
Officials say for now, no cattle are being allowed to graze in the Nimule area. They are being held in a camp near the center of the state. Lejuru says his government is also prepared to address any and all concerns the host community might have regarding the displaced people residing in the area, but he remains firm on his decision. Daniel Owenakot, who sits on the National Crisis Management Committee, was part of the team that evaluated the situation. He says if Nimule residents knew what had happened to the arrivals from Bor, they would not ask them to move again.
I will go and hire a plane and they go to see what has happened in Bor. Because seeing is believing. Go and see with your own eyes. For I need Mahdi with the God gift to you of this good Black Soil Land, please accommodate them for the time being. And you will see if things goes better, you will see these people going back very quickly.
There have been no report of violence between the displaced and the host community. For BOA News, I'm Philip Aleu in Juba.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
In recent years, Africans have made progress in the fight against HIV/AIDS. Prevention programs, new medicines, and changes in behavior have brought infection rates down dramatically. But this success could be in danger if people are not careful about sexual activity. Those displaced from their homes by war and civil unrest are at a greater risk of sexual violence, which can spread the disease. Advice and information are available from health centers in many areas. So understand the risks, take precautions, and protect yourself from HIV/AIDS.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the Information Minister of Sudan says President Bashir wants an open dialogue on the future of the country. That report is coming up.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com.
southsudan@voanews.com.
We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan.
www.voanews.com/South Sudan.
Or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what limits, if any, should be put on free speech?
My understanding to a limitation on freedom of speech is that people should not abuse those in public life recklessly.
Well, I don't think that there shall be any limit for free speech because, you know, in our constitution, people talk of right to express an assembly.
Me, I think there's no limit that should be set for freedom of speech. Somebody should speak whatever that is important for development for the country. So if you limit me to some extent, if I see something wrong, you expect me to keep quiet? No.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's Minister of Information says President Omar al-Bashir is expected to meet this week with more political leaders in an effort to drum up a national dialogue on the future of Sudan. Last Friday, Mr. Bashir met with Hassanat Torabi, leader of the Islamist Opposition Popular Congress Party. Ahmed Bilal tells James Batty that the president, who is wanted by the ICC on war crime charges, wants an open dialogue about Sudan, including the role of religion in politics.
Actually, the president met Sadiq al-Mahdi, the opposition leader before, Ummah Party leader, last week. And he's going to meet the others, the Communist Party and all the leaders of the opposition as well as the leaders of the governing parties which are participating in the government. The talk is actually about how to reach a roadmap for the solution of all the problems of the Sudan. Political, economical, and social, and even about the association between the religion and the politics. All this is going to be discussed, and what we reach about is going to be adopted by the president and by the governing party.
Your critics say that since he announced this dialogue, the president is not very serious about carrying it through. So how serious is President Bashir?
He is very serious. A lot of homework has been done already, and I assure you the president is very serious. The leading party, the NCM, is also very serious, and we are very optimistic that we could reach some sort of consensus how to lead the country and how to reach consensus about the constitution and about the next election, how to be. Even a transitional government can be also one of the items which can be discussed and agreed upon.
What does that mean, even transitional government? Does that mean that President Omar al-Bashir will form a coalition government with some members of the opposition?
No, not that. Actually, a scenario very similar to that one happened in Tunisia is going to happen in Sudan. What happened in Tunisia is that the governing parties as well as the opposition parties together, they reach a consensus about the constitution and about a program for a transitional government. Then all they agreed about it and they made a government which does not actually from this party or that. It is a technocrat government which is going to lead Tunisia for 1 year and to prepare for the elections. This will happen in Sudan as well also. We'll do that. We'll agree about all the items, especially how to reach peace and stability in Sudan, then the economical situation, all these and the reforms and political reforms and these things, if we agree about, then a transitional government is going to be constituted.
That's Sudanese Information Minister Ahmed Bilal speaking with James Batty. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. The United States and its European allies are expected to announce sanctions against Russia today, a day after Crimea's vote to secede from Ukraine and join Russia. U.S. President Barack Obama told his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, yesterday that Washington and its European partners are prepared to impose additional costs, quote-unquote, on Moscow for backing a secession referendum in Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. A White House statement called Sunday's referendum illegal and said it violates Ukraine's constitution. It also said the vote will never be recognized by the United States and the international community. Malaysia said today that the search for a missing passenger jet is underway along both the northern and southern corridors, where it is believed to have been deliberately diverted. Defense Minister Hishamuddin Hussein says 26 countries are involved in the search, including in water and on land in 11 countries. The search spans tens of millions of square kilometers. Investigators believe the Boeing 777 flew either north toward Central Asia or south, deeper into the vast Indian Ocean in the hours after it mysteriously vanished on March 8th. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott today agreed to take charge of the southern section of the search at the request of Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak. And finally, the Pentagon says U.S. Navy SEALs have seized an oil tanker carrying crude illicitly obtained from a rebel-held port in Libya. The Defense Department said today that no one was hurt in the boarding of the stateless vessel seized earlier this month by three armed Libyans. The statement goes on to say that the action was requested by the Libyan and Cypriot governments and approved by President Obama. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam. CJ Oman.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Junubia by CJ Oman. Listening to CJ Oman with the song Junubia. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.